back to Real Crime Profile. I'm Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler and former New York City prosecutor, and we're talking about The People versus O.J. Simpson. With me today is...
Laura Richards, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service and criminal behavioral analyst.
And Lisa Zambetti, casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague.
And today we're going to be discussing episode 5 of The People versus O.J. Simpson. This episode was entitled Race Card. And basically, that is another way of saying, I think it's a Johnny Cochran commercial. And I think it was basically his idea, at least as depicted, that he should focus on the racial divide in the city of Los Angeles in the wake of the Rodney King incident and acquittals of the police officers, to use that as an advantage in the defense of O.J. Simpson. So one of the first things that obviously stood out in this episode to me was the incident in which Johnny Cochran was driving. In this case, it depicted him with two of his daughters in the back of a Mercedes-Benz. And he was pulled over by a sole police officer on a motorcycle. But as Laura Richards pointed out, that's not exactly what it was like in the real world.
Well, it certainly happened in, this incident did happen, but it happened in 1980, not 1982. And I think it was a son and a daughter in the back of the car, and they were on their way to buy some toys rather than going to, I think in the show it showed that they were going somewhere to eat.
Yeah, yeah, Hamburger Hamlet or something.
But it was here in LA, Laura?
It was, yeah. I mean, it did happen, and a number of the things that they portrayed in the show sort of underplayed what really went on, which is interesting.
Right. He was actually driving a Bentley, I believe, or a Rolls-Royce, I can't remember. But he was driving a very expensive car and through a very expensive neighborhood. And in fact, it was three LAPD police cars that pulled him over, and all the officers got out, and they were all had their guns drawn. And why would something like that happen? Well, they made some assumptions that somebody who's African-American, who's driving through a rich neighborhood with a very expensive car, a car that none of them could ever afford, they made an assumption that he was probably getting his money illegally through drugs or something like that, and therefore that he would be dangerous. And therefore, they all did what we call a felony car stop, which means when you think somebody has committed a felony and they're dangerous, that it is a very sort of overwhelming force type of stop. In other words, they want to make sure that if anything happens, that nobody thinks that they can overpower the police and get away, with whatever crime they're committing. But it is really interesting that they underplayed that in the series, where they seem to be overplaying so much of the other stuff. It's kind of curious, don't you think?
Yeah, it is odd. You think that they would go for the drama? I mean, if that really happened, especially if it's documented,
right?
You know, it's so easy for us to find out that it was, you know, a different situation. Yeah. It is odd.
Yeah, but I think that it kind of goes along with the way that scene was written, though. I'm pretty sure it didn't play out that way. Now, I will tell you that when you're a prosecutor, when you're a police officer, when you're an FBI agent, for that matter, you're not supposed to try to use that to get out of a ticket, to get out of, if you did something wrong, you can't use your position legally to get out of a ticket or an arrest or something. In fact, a number of prosecutors and cops and lawyers and agents even have actually gotten arrested for trying to do that, using their position to get out of something that they did wrong. But in this case, he claimed that he was stopped for nothing, that there was no actual legitimate reason for him to be stopped.
And I think he said it was the third time he'd been stopped that week.
Yes. And I think that, you know, this is something real, and I'm sure it still continues today, not everywhere, but in many places where people get stopped for driving while black. And some people get stopped for walking while black. And I know there's a lot of videos on YouTube that point this out still today. And for example, with open carry laws, there are places, states, and where it's legal to open carry weapons. And when white people walk down the street with a weapon exposed, they keep walking down the street. When black people do, or people of color do, they get arrested. They get prone down on the ground. They get, you know, guns pointed at them. It's a very dangerous situation. And I think that is an important point that the showmakers actually wanted to display in this episode, which I think is important. However, I don't believe that it actually went down the way they said in terms of what Johnny Cochran said to the police officers. Now, I'm sure, having had experienced this a number of times, that he knew what was coming when it happened, and I would imagine that he was probably a little quicker than they depicted in this scene to actually tell them that he was actually an assistant district attorney, a prosecutor in the city of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. At that time, before he went to the other side as defense attorney, which is a very common thing, by the way. Most people who join the prosecutor's office stay for 3 to 5 years and then become defense attorneys because if you're going to go into the private practice, private world, you can't prosecute. You can't prosecute unless you work for the government. And or there's some really rare cases where private attorneys are special prosecutors appointed by when there's a conflict of interest. But in most cases, that doesn't happen.
Well, actually, when we get to her, Marcia Clark actually started out as a defense attorney before she became a prosecutor.
Yeah, that's a much less common phenomenon. Most of the time, it's prosecutors who then become defense attorneys. So this episode, named Race Card, is also where the makers of the series bring up the issue of Detective Mark Furman. And there's a lot of foreshadowing here because when Darden interviews Furman, he gets a real bad feeling about him. He doesn't feel like this guy is actually on the level, and he looks at his history, and there's been a number of complaints against him for racial issues. Because of that, Darden approaches Marcia Clark and says, I don't think we should call him. He should not be a witness for the prosecution in this trial. And she basically gives him the, don't be silly, it's not going to be a problem. He only found a couple of pieces of evidence. And, there were four cops on the scene who saw the evidence at the original crime scene before Furman even got there. So nobody can actually claim that he put that stuff there, like the glove and the hat and all the blood evidence and so forth. One other thing that I wanted to talk about that was brought out in this episode was about the fact that some of the detectives bought evidence collected at the crime scene out to their homes to Simi Valley overnight because they were working very late it's early into the morning on the night of the murders. This is actually an issue that they made a lot of in the trial, but the fact is that happens all of the time. Many jurisdictions across this country, and there are 17,000 police agencies in the United States of America, many of them do not have evidence vaults that stay open 24 hours a day. And it is the responsibility of police officers to maintain a chain of custody over the evidence that they collect at a crime scene. And certainly, if there is an evidence vault that's open when you finish collecting, you should bring that to the evidence vault and make sure it's preserved properly and so forth. But it is part of that responsibility, if the evidence vault is closed, that many police officers will lock the evidence they have in evidence bags. They'll be sealed in evidence bags in the trunk of their car, and they'll transport it to the evidence vault as soon as they have their next availability. Sometimes they have to leave a crime scene, drive to protect a witness, as in this case, drive to, an intervening crime happens in the middle of it, This happens all the time. And the fact is, it's down to the word of that police officer, which is why police officers have to have the highest level of integrity. They have to do what's right all the time. The slightest little deviation from that, they can lose their reputation. And I think we'll see that sort of expanded to the nth degree when we talk about Detective Furman later.
Yeah, I don't think I realized that the police officers themselves took evidence. I thought it was the technicians or whoever arrives later that collects the evidence and keeps it together and cataloged.
It depends on the crime. It depends on the situation. Sometimes crime scene people are not called in. Sometimes they are called in. Sometimes they miss things. I mean, there's all sorts of different. They should be, the crime scene should be documented. The crime scene should be handled by crime scene investigators, and the evidence should be taken by them. But there are pieces of evidence that are collected by investigating detectives throughout the course of an investigation. And whether it happens on day one or day 557, the detective has to have the responsibility and the integrity to collect that, to seal it, to sign the evidence tape that closes it with the date and time that he does that. And then any time it's opened, that has to be resealed and re-signed. And you saw issues with that in the Avery case.
Sure.
Where the blood evidence, although it was sealed properly originally, that when it was tested, it was not resealed properly, and it gave the impression that somebody got in there and did something bad with that evidence. And that's why you have to do it right every time. Otherwise, you'll have the defense poking holes in your case. And I think the OJ case was a watershed moment for evidence collection in the history of U.S. law enforcement, because it taught, and it is used in teaching law enforcement agencies across the country, about how evidence must be handled. Otherwise, the defense can get your case thrown out,
contaminated and compromised. And in fact, in the UK, you know, we have dedicated exhibit officers. I mean, that's how seriously it's taken, so that that chain of custody, you have one person who's the focus and the dedication. And certainly we know in the OJ case, and Jim and I will talk about it another time, not today, but just all these issues around contamination and crime scenes being compromised had a very profound impact on another very high profile case, which we will discuss in another podcast.
But at this point in the series, it definitely looks like there is going to be a looming issue with Detective Furman, and they dramatically cut to a scene in which he's at his home, presumably with a huge display of World War II medals, and of course, including Nazi memorabilia, and that is an indication that he may actually be a white supremacist.
So what's your feeling about Furman? I'm curious.
I think it's obvious at this point that he is an issue, and I think it was very short-sighted on the part of Marshall Clark not actually delving into his disciplinary history and finding out exactly what kind of person he was. Also, is a little interesting that Marshall Clark decides that Darden would be the one to do the direct examination of Detective Furman. And I think she deliberately did that because she wanted an African-American man to be presenting this guy to the jury, sort of trying to overcome any argument that he could be a racist. Obviously, that was a strategic move that did not work very well for the prosecution. And you'll see more about that in episode 9, I believe. Mm-hmm.
Seems like also just the defense was really good at discrediting all of the detectives. I mean, including Van Adern and the others, as kind of being bumbling oafs. I mean,
but it was Cochrane's strategy, wasn't it? And I think you've got to place it in its strategic context. You know, you want to basically ensure it's not just the messenger that's being discredited, it's the message too. So Cochrane had a very clear strategy, the 3 C's. You know, it's about contamination, being compromised and corrupt. And that's exactly what they tried to do, make it a trial about something else, create storytelling. And they did it in such a spectacular way that they outgunned the prosecution, and Marsha not changing tact or realising that strategy, you know, how powerful that was going to be, not doing her due diligence around Furman. You know, even when Dryden's saying that they shouldn't call him and she's not taking heed of what he's saying. And in fact, she makes comment about it much later on in the trial and reflects on that. But she didn't heed the warning signs.
Right. Yeah, and I think that when you're talking about strategy, the ultimate sort of clash on that strategy came when Darden made an application to the court that they would not be raising the issue of the N-word. And I believe that his statements were pretty accurate. I mean, though summarized in the actual show. And I thought they were very well delivered. It was an attempt to try to prevent the defense from straying off and using a completely irrelevant aspect of culture or the dynamic in the city of Los Angeles and make that a major part of the case. And because Cochran is such a... he's a great orator. He's a great actor. He was able to blatantly lie, and I mean that in every sense of the word, blatantly lie that the N-word is not even going to be an issue in this case, and that people of African-American descent can hear that word and not be affected by it emotionally. But he deftly argued that it was racist to say that they would be emotionally overpowered by the use of that language. And
yeah, that was a brilliant turn. That's really...
yeah, he's very good at manipulating words and people and circumstances.
He's the master of spin. I mean, he is a complete spin doctor.
He is. He really is. But again, I think it's one of these things you're going to hear from me a lot when I'm talking about this show and when I'm talking about cases in general, that defense attorneys do not feel constrained by the truth. They feel like they are, it's okay for them to do anything that they can come up with as long as it helps them get their client off. And in other words, they feel like justice means them being able to do whatever, but the prosecution and the cops and the court has to do what's right and do and stick to the truth and so forth. So it's really a dichotomy that they set up, and I think it's hypocritical as hell, and I think we're going to see a number of different examples of this as we go on throughout this series.
So speaking of that, Jim, let me read you this on our Facebook page from one of our listeners. So amazingly biased. Unless Jim was sitting in the room with OJ's lawyers, he has no right to say that they don't care about justice. They were defending their client to the best of their abilities. If anyone is to be criticized, it's the prosecution for losing such an obvious case. I'd be interested what Jim would have done if he was OJ's lawyer. If OJ was saying he was innocent, you can advise him the weight of the evidence is against him, but you can't make him plead. So he doesn't plead. What do? You look for errors or problems in the prosecution's case, and it seems that there are enough problems and errors to create a reasonable doubt. You can't just criticize the defense advocate for doing his job.
Well, if he were just doing his job, that's one thing. But there are a number of instances in which he went above and beyond, not just doing his job, but actually literally lying, having other attorneys on the defense team literally lie to the court. When you're an attorney and you're actually appearing before a court, there is an ethical set of standards. And if you violate those ethical set of standards, one, you can be disbarred. In other words, you will never be able to try another case again or represent anybody else legally again. And two, you could be prosecuted, held in contempt. You could be thrown in jail. But none of that happened in this case because I believe Judge Ito was bending over backwards for the defense. He allowed the defense to do so many things that in other cases would have been thrown out of court. And that's what I'm reacting to. And you can call me biased, that's fine, but I am actually an experienced prosecutor, an experienced investigator, and I have been through many trials. I know what's right and what's wrong in a court of law, and I know that these guys on the defense team got away with literally lying to the court. And had that been known at the time, they could have been disbarred or held in contempt. But I don't believe Judge Ito made a single attempt to find out what was behind some of the statements that were made. I think he just took them at face value because attorneys are supposed to be telling the truth in a court of law. That's what pisses me off.
Yeah, and I think there's a right context for that, for what Jim's saying. I mean, certainly when we understand that OJ's house was completely transformed to make him look completely different from the person that he was. And these are all things that were blatant untruths that they use to steer their case. So it's not just a case of being biased. It's actually based on fact of what happened.
Right. I mean, Marsha Clark tried to get Judge Ito to prevent the jury from visiting the home because it had manipulated the crime scene. There was no way. This was actually a crime scene because there was blood there from the victims of a crime. That means that it is something relevant and the jury should be able to see it. But when they change it, completely misrepresenting what OJ's life is like, it manipulated the jury.
And they're going there to see that firsthand. That's the whole point of the expense of taking a courtroom out to a crime scene. It's so that they can see it through their eyes, because a picture can paint a thousand words, but going to a scene tells you millions of things, as Jim and I well know. And the very fact they go out to Nicole's house and she has been erased from her home, you know, again, these things, it's not just about a matter of opinion, it's actually about fact of what happened.
Right, so had they, that's not about rightly defending your client. That's about manipulating the evidence in a trial. And what and you'll see many more examples of this throughout this series because it happened throughout that trial. And to take all of Nicole's furniture and pictures, anything that showed her as a human being, as a mother, as a person, out of that house, and then let the jury walk around this empty place.
And then depict her as a, you know, a coke-taking party, you know, fest female who, you know, is crazy at the very least. So all these things played into a strategy. And I do think the defence had a very clear strategy. And of course, they were adept at reviewing it. They had five great heads thinking about how they do that, as well as other experts helping them. And certainly, Jim, you know, we talked a little bit just about press conferences, you know, Johnny Cochran was sort of a one-man band with Shapiro in terms of calling the press and being able to manipulate them. And you know, obviously, once you can manipulate the journalists, you can then manipulate people's views about what's going on. He makes it a much bigger trial. Actually, it's not about the two murders. It's about something far bigger.
Right. And that's why I said his statements in the court about the use or non-use of the N-word were actually disingenuous as hell. I mean, he knew very well that he was using that. And every chance he got during the course of that trial, he would get African-American leaders and community members all riled up about issues because he knew there would be a backlash and a ripple effect in the courtroom. He knew Judge Ito would be affected by that. And he used that. But guess what? The prosecution doesn't have that ability. The prosecution does not do that same thing. They are bound by the rules of law, and for the most part, they stick to them. In this case, you saw all sorts of things going on by the defense, but the prosecution literally had to keep it to the law. And they made a number of decisions just so they wouldn't be manipulating the public. For example, not trying the case in Santa Monica instead of downtown L.A. If they had tried the case in Santa Monica, the jury pool would have been a majority white. But they didn't do that because it would be the appearance of impropriety. Even if it wasn't improper, it would look that way. And so the prosecution constrained themselves where the defense did not.
I think Marsha, I mean, we'll come on to it, but later on, and, you know, when we discuss Marsha, she did make a very clear point to Cochran that, you know, back alley tactics and stuff isn't her bag. And, you know, seemingly they played a relatively straight game. That's not to say they didn't have a strategy, but of course, each point of their strategy seemed to go out the window, you know, with the defence's kind of review and wheeling and dealing and discovery of new bits of information that will help their case. And Furman, of course, was a low-hanging fruit. There should have been some due diligence around him, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Not just about racism, but also about sexism. And I know we're come on to that.
Well, I think, and I started to say, with respect to the defense changing all the furnishings and the pictures in the house, in OJ's house, when Marsha saw that, she asked Judge Ito on the front lawn of Rockingham to have a hearing right then and there and disallow the jury from going in. And Judge Ito decided right there, no, we're going to let them go. We're here. We're going to let them go in. And, you know, it's the kind of thing, it's sort of the underhanded thing when the defense in the opening statements made a deliberate decision not to tell the prosecution about 12 witnesses they intended to call. That is a legal obligation. And they lied. They had one of their junior attorneys lie to say that it was an accident. It was unintentional. It's just miscommunication between all the different law firms, when in fact that was not the truth. And something as simple as that, a lie like that could get you disbarred, could get you held in contempt of court. But because nobody knew what was going on, the machinations that happened behind the scenes, the judge just accepted it at face value and they went on. So now the prosecution has to deal with the fact that we're in the middle of a trial and they don't have a complete list of all the defense's witnesses. Maybe you don't think that's necessary. You know, if you're out there in the real world listening to this, but the fact is, a prosecution, I mean, they have to be prepared for the witnesses. This is how it becomes a, quote, fair fight. But clearly, the defense was not fighting fair, and they were fighting for their client by doing just outrageous manipulations. If people think that's great, fine. But wait
till
you're...
dirty tactics, I mean, quite frankly. And Cochrane says, you know, sometimes you've got to fall on your sword for your client. And, you know, that was an intentional strategy that he had. A junior person on the team took the fall for it. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, they continue. And, of course, you know, it led to that quite dramatic courtroom scene where Bill Hodgson, you know, has a heart problem. But, in fact, that was actually in the chambers,
right.
I believe.
Right, he didn't actually have that then. But I do remember when he collapsed. Right. And
Yeah, having had a heart attack myself, I'm sure that was an incredibly distressful time for Bill. He was an accomplished attorney, a seasoned court prosecutor, and he had...
He was a senior prosecutor on the case.
And he definitely would have helped prosecute this case, but he was then taken out of action. Not, I mean, nothing deliberate on the part of the defense, but it was one of the bad breaks that the prosecution got. There will be more, believe me. So yeah, episode 6 is called Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. And it couldn't be more ridiculous, in my mind, what happened to her during the course of the trial. To have the media focus on her hair and her clothing and her makeup it's just ridiculous. I think it is misogynistic, first of all, and I think it is professionally unprofessional for media people to attack a prosecutor for her sense of style. What do you think, Laura?
I mean, I completely agree, but we still see this stuff going on now, present day, and you know, it was really tough to watch, to see somebody go through that, not just in terms of, you know, cameras being in the courtroom for the first time, but also such personal attacks on her. I mean, we saw nothing about, you know, what Cochrane was wearing or what Shapiro was wearing. No one's interested in that. So why is it that women attract, you know, that kind of criticism? But also the fact that, you know, the way that she came across, in inverted commas, people saying that she's cold and that she's a bitch, where... To me, watching her, she's being professional. Why is that different when a female behaves in that way to a man behaving in that way? You know, she certainly was, at her time, you know, a phenomenal prosecutor, but she wasn't being judged on that.
No, she wasn't at all. Not on the 19 wins that she had previously.
Right.
She was being judged on her hair and makeup and clothing. I mean, it's just outrageous. I do remember when I was a prosecutor once being judged by my clothing. I was presenting a case, a trial before Judge Judy Scheindlin, who you might all know as Judge Judy. She would go on to become very famous on TV. And I think anybody who's watched her show at all knows that her personality is quite forward, I'll say, and aggressive. She was like that in the real world as a judge. And her husband, by the way, is also a judge. But one time she stopped a trial and said, "Mr. Clementi, is that a sharkskin suit you're wearing?" I mean, at the time... I was a poor, you know, young prosecutor. I actually bought my clothes at thrift stores on Broadway and 8th Street in Manhattan.
Sure.
I loved that stuff. I loved sort of the 50s style. And yes, I was wearing a sharkskin suit that was probably authentic from the 50s. And I recently ran into Judge Judy at the Montage, and I talked to her about that situation, and we all had a good laugh. many years later. So
she, by the way, always wore a little lace collar over her.
Like a doily kind of thing. It was crazy. But she was great. We loved her as prosecutors because she knew the law and she wouldn't take any crap. If Judge Judy had been trying the O.J. Simpson trial instead of Judge Ito, I think we would have had a radically different verdict. Mm. I don't think she would have let the prosecution get away with anything, nor would she have let the defense get away with anything.
And the other interesting thing about her, as you mentioned, Jim, 19 successful cases tried. She prosecuted 60 jury trials, including 20 murder cases. So we're talking about someone who's very experienced. And I also want to give a nod to her because she was also one of the women who took to trial one of the first very high-profile stalking cases.
That's right.
Rebecca Schaefer, who was stalked and murdered by someone called Robert Bardot, who was a fan, so a fanatic, who was obsessed with Rebecca Schaefer. And I know this case very well because I train law enforcement on it fairly regularly across the globe, because it's the case where the stalking law actually came in following this particular high-profile trial in 1991. So California was the first state, and the US being the first country to actually create a stalking law. And Marsha was an absolute stalwart in ensuring this case got to trial. So this was a prosecutor who absolutely understood stalking behaviour, obsessive behaviour, and when people fixate, and domestic violence and domestic abuse. And yeah, I think that's full credit to her. However, absolutely, it didn't come off that knowledge and that understanding and the way the strategy was put together for this particular case.
So, Laura, you brought up the Rebecca Schaefer murder, and I remember that murder very clearly. Rebecca Schaefer was a beautiful, funny, talented young actress who had her own show called My Sister Sam, if some of you remember that show. And she was just lovely, full of life. And I just remember how shocking it was that this stalker literally walked up to her front door, knocked on the door, and just shot her right in the chest. I mean, it was just shocking that he could just do something so blatantly, and why don't you take it from there? Do you know?
Yeah, and this case, you know, has one that I've been training law enforcement on for many years now, and it's just fascinating that it was Marsha's case when I believe she was the deputy district attorney, and you know, she did a phenomenal job on it. But why I train law enforcement on it is because it's the case that preceded the stalking law coming in California. So the first state in the US was the first country to actually legislate for the crime of stalking. And it was actually then after that, the first crime that went to trial for stalking was Steven Spielberg's case. Mm. So anyway, tracking back, Rebecca Schaefer, yeah, she was an actress, and she was, you know, going through the, I guess, coming up from, you know, C status probably to A, celebrity A-list. And unfortunately, she had a number of fans, fanatics, and one in particular was someone called Robert Bardot. And he obsessed about her. He wrote to her prolifically. And normally when people write prolifically, they don't tend to act on the things that they're saying. But this was somebody who felt he was in love with her and she was in love with him. And every time she did a movie, he felt she was communicating to him. And unfortunately, her last movie, there was a love scene. And he believed that she had therefore been unfaithful to him in his mind. And therefore, he paid a detective to track her down. And unfortunately, you know, and it was some months later where it was found out where she was living. And he did exactly do that, make an approach, and he killed her. And we would call him a howler rather than a hunter, writing prolifically to someone, but would rarely then take the steps to kill. And therein lies a lesson when you're risk assessing and you're doing threat assessment. Someone called Jeff Dunn, who's just retired from the LAPD threat assessment unit, would always say, and it's certainly what I tell law enforcement all the time, that doing any form of actuarial risk assessment, this is the case that tells us that these actuarial assessments, when you're adding up numbers, just do not work. Because here's a case where all the literature would tell us that this is somebody who would not mean the target any harm, but actually it's the 1% of cases where he does something completely different. And Marsha understood it for what it was and made sure that this case went to trial. And in fact, Robert Bardot was sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole for stalking and murdering Rebecca Schaefer. And I absolutely believe that it was down down to Marsha's hard work.
Now, didn't he run away? He ran back to Arizona, and she was able to get him back into the state. And
absolutely. She doggedly pursued him and made sure that he was put before the court. So, you know, this all goes as testament to the fact that she was an incredibly successful, you know, big trial lawyer. She wasn't inexperienced. But I think, you know, when we look at her in that show, you know, does she come across particularly well? Well, not at the beginning. And I think the calibre of the acting is amazing. So that's something else. Sarah Paulson does an amazing job. But I think in particular, you know, her character is assassinated because she comes across as serious and, you know, the sort of the ice queen, as it were, with no real emotion and no real personality. But there she is doing her job and being professional. And she is a working mother thrusted mm-hmm. into the spotlight in this huge trial. A working single mother, indeed.
Yeah, ugly divorce going on at the
same time. Going through
a
divorce. And so all of these issues that when our relationships are, collapsing or our relationships are breaking up around us, it's tough on its own. But when that is the thing that's put into the media glare and when you personally are being focused upon, so it's personal, not professional, it's a really tough thing for somebody to try and manage and to even get into court every day and try and put that behind her and have amnesia. You know, I think we need to step into her shoes and just think about what that means for her in terms of the role that she's playing, this huge, high-profile case that she's now a part of. And, you know, a lot of this, I think in particular for me, the sexism of this time, and particularly with this trial, which hasn't really been discussed before. Mm. I think this is the first time really it's come into the media, spotlight.
I wonder if there's ever been, if the audience had ever really seen a strong female prosecutor like that. Maybe it was just...
Well, I know that when was it, the 80s, I guess, that L.A. Law was popular on TV, mm-hmm. that female enrollment in law school went up 20% during that time because
really?
They showed some, you know, actually fictional strong female lawyers.
Sure, but they were sexy and you were dating Harry Hamlin.
Well,
and
that's
the whole...
what they were expecting,
right,
correct.
Right.
Yeah, that's what they were expecting when the real world, you know, there's no reason for that. That's mm-hmm. that's just a bunch of dramatic garbage. But speaking of dramatic garbage, I think that's a good segue into what Johnny Cochran tried to pull in this episode, which was in the beginning of the prosecutor's case. See, the prosecution gets to present their entire case, every witness that they want to call, in a row. But the defense, Johnny Cochran claimed that Rosa Simpson, I think she was a maid from a neighbor's house, that she said she saw the Bronco parked on the street at a time when the murders would have been happening. And it really screwed up the DA's timeline in two ways. I mean, one, her testimony would have screwed up the timing of it and the ability of OJ to have done the crime, but also it screwed up the momentum of the prosecution's case. And I think it was a deliberate attempt on the part of Cochran. When Rosa actually testified, it was very clear that she was only doing it because Cochran said she should do it. She did not buy tickets to get out of the country. She bought them the morning she was going to trial. I mean, it was just ridiculous. There was no actual emergency that made her have to testify at that point. It was a manufactured manipulation, again, one of many, that I am going to point out, even if it looks like I'm biased because of it. But I'm going to tell you every single time I can, when I believe that they stepped out of line, when they didn't just defend their client within the bounds of the Constitution, but literally stepped outside, lied to manipulate the court and to manipulate the prosecution and to manipulate the public into forcing their hand so that they could, you know, pretty much guarantee that OJ would get off.
I want to talk about the National Enquirer. One more thing that I found disgusting was how Marsha's ex-mother-in-law sold nude photos of her to the National Enquirer, and they, you know, hit the public. And what that must be like to have such privacy
violation
and to have intrusion. To be a professional and walk through that door and see every single man look at you. And it must have been horrifying. And
yeah, first
Sarah Paulson certainly portrayed that, but...
Yeah, first of all, let's define these pictures. I mean, they weren't completely nude pictures. She had taken her top off on a beach in on an island somewhere on vacation. It wasn't her being, you know, sexually active on film or something like that.
Exactly.
But certainly they turned it into, it was with her husband at the time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is before social media and all, you know,
right.
So the context is it's old photographs of being on a beach with her husband.
On a topless beach with her husband, where it was completely in context, completely normal and natural and nothing bad or unprofessional about it. But it was turned into something unprofessional. It was turned into something just disgusting, like you said.
Well, talk about sexism. I mean, what does it have to do with anything? I mean,
Who dug it up? Who decided to go down? You know, did these pictures just suddenly come into the ether, or were there people working behind the scenes trying to find these, you know, pictures like this? And I think that scene was very moving, actually, with because that did happen. That is a truism that, you know, she did break down in court, and Judge Ito did give a recess. But yes, I mean, and that's what I mean in terms of everything she's facing going in there every day, and certainly, you know, feeling exposed and feeling vulnerable and still having to do that job. So the human side of people, whether you're a prosecutor, whether you're a defence lawyer, whether you're a police officer, no matter what you're doing, you know, people are human beings. But I think that was a real dirty tactic. And I, you know, for me, I think it was just another tactic that was being used to undermine the prosecution and, you know, Marsha Clark in particular.
To just distract on what this trial is really about. It's not about a topless, you know, woman on her honeymoon. It's, you know, like what, just to degrade her and make her seem like,
well, it's very personal again. I mean, that's the whole, you know, rub about the nuanced and kind of very personal aspects to this, where, you know, this is absolutely about sexism, and, you know, that some people might not like that being said, but that is the out and out truth and fact of it, that the male prosecutor, I mean, certainly the male defence lawyers weren't being treated in the same way. So, you know, whether that was an out and out tactic to try and dig up things on her, which my suspicious mind and being cynical, I believe that that probably did happen. And these are all the sorts of things that she was having to confront and perform her job in front of all the cameras and try and get the best outcomes.
So one of the things I'd like to talk to you about, Laura, is sort of the profile of each of the lawyers. And since we're talking about Marsha Clark in this episode, Marsha, I think there's some important things that I saw in the real Marsha Clark that I think, you know, we should discuss. One thing, I think she's definitely articulate and intelligent. I think those things come out in her opening statement, in how she dealt with certain arguments that came up through the trial. But I think that she also looked like she was stressed to the max. She looked depressed. At some points, you know, she had drawn cheeks and sunken eyes. She looked almost anorexic. And she was probably going through a hell of a lot with the divorce and taking care of her kids and being personally attacked. What do you think about that?
Well, I think anybody going through what she did would certainly be stressed. You know, she seemed to have far much more to contend with than anybody else. And I think that, you know, what you've said is absolutely right. She's not just on a national platform. She's on a world stage. And it's not just her abilities as a prosecutor that's being judged. It's her hair, it's her makeup, it's her clothes, it's her body, it's the way that she comes across, her characteristics, everything. I actually felt, you know, very much that she was the one that was put on trial for a time, as was Nicole, as was Ron. And everybody seemed to be put on trial other than O.J. Simpson.
That's correct. And I think some of the things that she's spoken about later that kind of shed light on this was the fact that she did have her first marriage, not the marriage that was just breaking up at this time, but her first marriage was actually an abusive relationship. Mm. Her first husband was physically abusive to her. Also, something that she talked about later on was the fact that she was on vacation in Europe and she was actually the victim of rape. So I think she was carrying around a lot more than you know the average person does. I think the fact that she was the victim of a rape probably made her a more staunch advocate for victims. And I think she really felt for Nicole and Ron and wanted to do the best she could. But I believe she was overwhelmed by the, as you called it, strategic decisions by the defense. I call it lies and manipulations by the defense. And I think she expected to be treated in a professional manner, and she was not. And like you, I'm pretty cynical about how the defense may have participated in the smear campaign of Marsha Clark, because I don't think it was just coincidental.
Well, I mean, I would agree with you. And I think certainly a lot of people who work and are advocates and do this type of work is normally because of their own experience. And that's why they become such a good ambassador and advocate. So that is no surprise. But I do think that in terms of, you know, her life, that she, you know, she was a person who felt shame and humiliation, and particularly about those pictures. And the tabloids, you know, really did make a spectacle of her, and her feelings must have been, you know, very difficult to contain and keep that professional front. But I think we all have masks that we put on that we have to wear. Some of us are in public jobs, others, you know, and certainly in terms of what played out at the trial, there were cameras in court the whole time, which, you know, as a prosecutor, there's one thing about, you know, the job that you're doing, but there's another about everything you're saying and doing being scrutinised and being talked about and being in the newspapers 24/7. That's really hard wearing for anybody. You know, was it that she was ill-prepared, or was it just that this was something, you know, extraordinary? And, you know, how do you prepare someone for this? And I know right now, you know, it's not as uncommon. And, of course, training and the fact that you could become in the public eye and all the things of your history could come up too. And dirty tactics do get played out. I'm certainly well aware of that. But, you know, this had a profound effect on her. She actually resigned and did not carry on as a trial lawyer, right, and had to move away from it. She said it was the worst 15 months of her life.
Right. And if you contrast that with Johnny Cochran, and when the information came out that he actually was physically abusive to his previous wife, and he actually feigned some kind of righteous indignation, and the press literally did not follow up.
What? Incredible.
What the hell
Absolutely incredible.
Is that all about?
And here's somebody, you know, Marsha has none of this in her background, but is actually vilified. But we see that a lot, you know, happen, even present day, where the true victim, or the person who actually is the person who's virtuous, doing all the right things, it's turned on its head, and it's actually them who come under the lens and the microscope. And Johnny Cochran, that's why I say he is the master of spin, you know, as were all the defence team, of being able to take, you know, what should have been a defeat and turn it into a victory, because he's so quick as a strategist to turn round his whole history of domestic violence and abuse to make it something that, how dare you actually even question me about this? We're talking about far more important things at this
right
trial.
And he's quick, sure-footed as hell, but he's also unconstrained by the truth. And that is something that you can't say about Marsha Clark or Darden. I think that's one thing that the TV show is depicting fairly well, is this sort of, you know, just shock on the part of Chris Darden at how he's being manipulated, how he's being disrespected. And it's very obvious that how much Marsha Clark was being disrespected.
I think that's a really good point, actually, Jim. You know, you feel the human emotion of both of those two people. You know, the human element of the insults and the things that are rubbing at their moral fibre, you know, their very being. And that's why you hear some of the outbursts that you do. But for Cochran et al., it's much more just about a game, and mm-hmm. it's about winning the game rather than actually it's something that's very personal, that's, you know, eating them up. So I think, yeah, Marsha, you can certainly see some of those demons all at play, mm-hmm. and you can see her under stress and under duress and not knowing at times which way to turn. But she's trying to come, you know, from the right intention, whereas the others are constantly thinking about how to use that information, how to manipulate it, how to exploit it. And it's a very different sense of those individuals and characters.
Correct. Mm. So I do have a recommendation. You'll be hearing from my friend James Fitzgerald, who was also a retired FBI supervisory special agent and profiler. We worked together in the Behavioral Analysis Unit and in New York City on the joint FBI-NYPD Bank Robbery Task Force before that. James Fitzgerald has written a series of books. The first one, A Journey to the Center of the Mind, book one. And this is the story of him coming of age and getting into the police department. And then book two has to do with his police career. And book three has to do with his FBI career. He's writing that one right now.
But, so this is not a fiction. This is
no. This is
there's no Tony Dante in this one.
No, right? There's no Tony Dante in this one. This is a very candid memoir, and it is. You will find that Jim is not only a wordsmith, but he has actually used words to solve some of the most amazing cases in the history of the United States criminal annals. So I really believe that this is an interesting book for you to read. I also want to say that I have started watching Happy Valley. I agree with the two of you that it is a really, really good series. I love, it's just real and gritty.
Yeah.
I really love it. So awesome. I do have to say, though, that every now and then I have problems with their regional dialects there because sometimes they speak so fast and I have to go back and play it a couple times to figure out what they said. But other than that, I think it's an amazing,
it's a good northern gritty show. And, you know, it's Sarah Lancashire really brings off the character. And certainly Sally Wainwright is who's the person who wrote it, someone who I know, actually. And I think she has done a fantastic job with, you know, some of their advisors as well. But season two, and I'm not going to spoil it, but Lisa and I are well and truly into our season two. And it's really, really good. So definitely look it up.
And one further thing is that you will probably hear or have heard that there's a new series coming on Discovery Channel called Manifesto. And this is a series that I and James Fitzgerald and my friend Tony Gittleson helped create. And we partnered with Kevin Spacey's company, Trigger Street.
Ooh,
and
fancy.
So hopefully this coming year, you'll be seeing that on Discovery Channel.
Do you need a casting director? We'll talk later.
Got one right in front of me.
Laura, you have a recommendation?
Yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, Fitz's book is definitely worth a read. And I was going to just give another shout out to a show, actually. It's one of my favorites. And the show's called The Killing. And the main character is Sarah Lund. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a woman who doesn't give too much concern to the jumpers that she wears, and you know she's brought the kind of Christmas jumper back. But it's a Nordic noir show, and I love it because it's so gritty.
So you mean the original show? I would love to see that.
Yeah, I'm talking about the Nordic noir show. I'm not talking about the US.
Good.
You
got to clarify that.
You have to watch it with the subtitles, I'm afraid, which means that you can't eat, talk, or do anything else. You've got to stay glued to the TV. And she's a brilliant character, flawed for lots of different reasons, but the show moves very quickly, and I defy any of you to get the first season and not be able to, you know, switch it off, because disc after disc you just want to get to the next part of the show. So definitely have a look at The Killing, the first season.
I got to get that, because I really want to. The lead actress who plays that detective, she's in a show that I'm going to recommend next time, not right now. Okay, so keeping with my anglophilic predilections, is that a word? Anglophilic. When you love everything about England. I lived there twice. Anyway, I have another show to recommend to you, also on Netflix, and it's called River. And it's a cop show. It follows this detective, this male detective played by Stellan Skarsgård. I don't know if you remember Good Will Hunting. He was the snobby professor. Or if you watched Deep Blue Sea, he was the snobby scientist. He always playing somebody snobby. But in this show, he plays the most emotionally rich character I've ever seen. I think you will really, really, if you stick with it, I think it's only 6 episodes. It's a slow burn. It's not fast paced at all. It's one you got to, you know, cuddle into your comforter with some chocolate hobnobs and a cup of tea and watch it. And I think you'll really love it. And by the last episode, if you're not crying your eyes out, you got to go to the hospital because you don't have a heart. So I really recommend this series called River on Netflix right now. So that's what I got.
That is episode 6 of People versus O.J. Simpson. And we are wrapping up this episode of Real Crime Profile. Thank you for listening.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214 946 4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800 799 7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions. Real Crime Profile is distributed by Wondery.